The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
In the chaotic jungle that is Argentine politics, a danger lurks that may threaten the entire world.
They're called Los Falcones.
The Knives?
Yeah, and get this, Stryker, they're Nazis.
Now what is a group of neo-Nazis doing with Arab terrorists?
We can't hold them off!
Gas! They're using gas!
Hey! The place is burning!
And now, a coup is boiling that will throw all of Latin America into chaos.
Kubrick! Save the governor!
And only Mac Bolan can stop it. The Executioner number 311, Night of the Knives.
Somewhere beyond the deepest jungles of Africa lies a buried weapon of such magnitude as to grant an overlord unbreakable control over humankind until the end of days. And there is a prince who is only too eager to help him find it. Cain must forge into the Dark Continent, where death can hide in every shadow to thwart the plans of Overlord Utu.
Mine the glory, Cain. Mine the glory. Fortune favored the sons of men for long enough. That time is over. Accept it.
I guess the Overlords aren't underestimating us the same way they did when they were barons.
A tribal kingdom is torn apart in the struggle of royal heirs, half-siblings, one worthy, one wicked. In their blood runs the key to Lord Utu's plans.
What are you really?
What I am is of no importance to you, Princess. It is what you are, and in what way you will serve me, that should concern you now.
Utu is the ancient god of all of Africa, sister. With his help, we will once again form a mighty army and will sweep forth upon the world like a pride of lions to restore our glory.
Untold power, ripe for the taking, lies wrapped in riddles, its doorway barred to all but a few. The question is, who will get there first? And God help Cain if he fails. The answer lies beyond the rim of the world.
And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terence Aselford, with performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, Colleen Delaney, David Coyne, Casey Jones, Ken Jackson, Ann Flosnick, Kate Torrey, Dolores King-Williams, and Mort Shelby. Outlanders number 3, Savage Sun. The day before Doomsday. Great Skellig, the southwest coast of Ireland. The 18-foot motor launch pitched and rocked on the relentless combers, white spray flying from the cresting waves. Inside the pilot housing, Brother Morn wrestled with the wheel and talked to himself. It was both a curse and a prayer. A squat man with the stocky build of a pipe fitter, his massive silver hair was swept back above a high forehead and a ruddy, weather-beaten face. There were only two specks of color about the man, a pair of cold, vivid blue eyes, and the spotless white rectangle of a cleric's collar at his throat. His strangely small, delicate hands gripped the wheel tightly. Peering through the droplets of water sliding across the windshield, Morn saw only the sea. The wipers droned steadily, but they were unable to keep the glass clear for more than an instant at a time. The hatch covering on the deck slid aside, and Karabatos struggled up from below. He was tall and gaunt. His leanness was accentuated by his black, impeccably tailored Armani suit, white silk shirt, and black necktie. Though the lighting inside the cabin was dim, he wore mirrored sunglasses. His short, close-cropped hair was a dark blonde, his pallid face furrowed and deeply seamed.
And how is our passenger holding up?
Karabatos stumbled as the craft yawed to port.
Still sleeping. God knows how in this shit.
Now, God Almighty has little to do with this journey, does he?
Karabatos didn't answer. From inside his coat, he took a package of cigarettes and shook one out.
This is a no-smoking voyage. We're damned enough as it is. We'll be smoking a plenty by this time tomorrow.
Speak for yourself, Paddy.
Allow me, old son.
Inscribed on the burnished steel surface of the lighter were glyphs resembling two scalene triangles flanking an isosceles. The points of the three triangles were topped by small circles. Karabatos leaned forward, setting his cigarette alight.
A little obvious, isn't it, to advertise the priory that way?
And what do your people do to recognize one another? Secret handshakes? A certain floral print on your undershirts? I love you bloody American spooks, I really do. Ye and your secret society barbecues and projects and lodge meetings and stock options in the future. What part of the coming wasteland have you reserved for yourself, may I ask?
You've got your orders. Shut up and drive.
Oh, I've got me orders, true enough. To observe the pact and betray an innocent. Who are you betraying? The CIA? The NSA? Your president? Your children? Your god?
Karabatos stiffened. He transferred the cigarette to his left hand as his right slid inside his coat. It came out, gripping a dull gray, compact Colt Delta 10mm automatic.
One more word and I'll blow your goddamn brains out and complete the transaction myself.
Oh, and keep me from missing humanity's final curtain. That'd be a bloody shame, wouldn't it? Armageddon out of here!
Karabatos stared at him blankly, eyes masked by the lenses of his glasses.
You're crazy.
Oh, I'm crazy. That Archon Directive's crazy. You're crazy. The whole bloody godforsaken world is crazy. Until tomorrow at noon. And then it won't be crazy anymore, will it? It'll simply be gone.
His eyes glimmered with tears, doubling the difficulty of gazing out of the water-splotched windscreen. His hands tightened on the varnished wood of the wheel, the knuckles standing out like ivory knobs.
Go ahead and blow me head off, you Gruagach spook.
Karabatos said nothing. Morn swiped a hand over his face, clearing his vision of tears. Dead ahead, the black triangle of Great Skellig reared out of the sea. A massive spire of rock and castellated walls. It loomed 700 feet above the North Atlantic, a dark silhouette thrusting up and piercing the sky. Misty clouds wrapped its sharp summit. Morn steered the launch on a parallel course with a vertical stone slab, following it into a small, straight-walled inlet protected on three sides from the open ocean. He guided the craft toward a concrete dock extending from one corner. A paved footpath cut into bare rock led away and up from it. Karabatos remained silent, not wanting to distract Brother Morn from piloting the boat close to the quay. Even inside the tiny harbor, the sea was turbulent, and a swell could easily pile the vessel up on the rocks. Morn expertly aligned the boat with the outer edge of the dock.
Make us fast!
Morn watched the American through the windshield, grudgingly admiring the man's deft, efficient movements. He knotted a hawser around a rusty cleat embedded in the concrete quay. Despite his lack of a topcoat, he didn't seem to feel the icy lash of the January wind or the snow on his uncovered head, probably too cold-blooded to notice the chill. Brother Morn stepped into the open hatchway, down a short ladder to the cabins below. Sliding open one of the wood-jalousied doors, he wasn't too surprised to see Sister Fand standing beside the bunk. Her almost inhumanly large, dark blue eyes were ringed with the shadows of fatigue and glassy with the long effort of fighting the barbiturates in her system. Masses of flaxen yellow hair tumbled about her high-planed face. The black habit she wore contrasted sharply with her milky white complexion. Tall she was, 2 inches taller than Morn. The shapeless garment she wore did little to conceal the ripe figure swelling beneath. Fand tugged at the steel cuff encircling her unnaturally long and slender wrist. A chain stretched from it to a bracket bolted in the cabin wall. She glared dazedly at him.
Morn!
Below!
Can't thought a sure look it.
At that moment, Karabatos descended the hatchway ladder.
Tell her to speak English.
You object to the tongue of your masters, do you?
What?
Gaelic is derived from Sanskrit, and Sanskrit is derived from the language of the Archons. That's common knowledge among the Priory.
She should still be asleep.
You can pump me so full of your damn juice that it comes out of me nose. I'll still not give you what you want.
Karabotos stepped into the cabin.
God, you bastard!
Karabotos stood over the woman, snatching her left wrist and pushing her face down against the mattress. Skillfully, he unlocked the steel circlet from the wall bracket, captured her flailing right hand, and pinned both wrists behind the small of her back. He cuffed her hands and stepped back, not even breathing hard. Sister Fan shouldered herself to a sitting position, the red imprint of the American's hand spreading over her face.
Done him done, divil am a done!
What did she say?
You don't want to know.
Morn moved to the woman's side and helped her to her feet. She tried to wrench herself away from his touch, but he held her firmly.
There's no point in resistance, sister. This is your fate. When you took your vows to the Priory, you swore unquestioned obedience.
My vows included chastity.
And a stranger to men you will remain. Technically.
Karabatos led the way from the cabin, down the short gangway and up to the pilot housing. He allowed Morn to guide Sister Fan to the deck. She didn't resist, but didn't give her full cooperation either. From a cabinet, Karabatos took a leather satchel, slinging the strap over his shoulder. Peeling back a shirt cuff, he glanced at his wristwatch.
We're off schedule. Sister, if you try to delay us, I'll knock you unconscious and drag you to the top. My orders were to escort you here. The choice of whether you arrive intact or not is up to you.
Fand said nothing, but her blue eyes were sapphire hard. The three of them went out on the rocking deck. The snow had turned to icy rain. Morn handed the woman to Karabatos on the quay. They walked the paved footpath as it ascended and curled around Great Skellig's almost perpendicular south side. The black peaks reared above them like vast permanent shadows. The path terminated in a weather-eroded stairway, chipped out of the rock face by monks 1,000 years before. 600 steps of differing widths led up the sheer black cliff. The three people scaled the crude, time-pitted notches, picking their way carefully. In some places, the steps were slippery with lichens and sea campions. Fand, still dizzy from the drugs, had to stop from time to time. Karabatos waited impatiently, drumming his fingers on the leather pouch.
Forward, forward, let us range! Let the great world spin forever down the ringing grooves of change!
What are you gibbering about now?
Tennyson, are you utterly without learning?
I'm a soldier and a scientist, not one of your country's fairy poets.
Neither was Tennyson, as I recall. Come along, sister.
The fairy tales of science, and the long result of time.
The stairway led into a tunnel under a retaining wall. They made their way up the steep slant, shoes slipping and sliding on the wet stones. They climbed through the passage and onto a rock-strewn plateau. It leveled off in a series of narrow terraces. A flagstone path wound among a cluster of little beehive-shaped stone huts constructed of flat, interlocking rocks. The path widened into a miniature walled plaza lined by leaning tombstones topped by Celtic crosses. Their inscriptions had long ago been effaced into illegibility by the harsh wind and the merciless hand of centuries. They passed through the plaza and stopped in a clearing among the stones. No lichen, grass, or moss grew on the earth. In the center of the bear patch rose a stele, a stone column with a cross piece of two blunted knobs. The weathered carvings formed swirling geometric abstractions. Carabatos, Brother Morn, and Sister Fand stood and stared.
Now what? They know we're here, don't they?
The carved column of rock suddenly quivered, and a circular crack split the naked ground around it in a disquieting symmetrical pattern. Slowly, smoothly, the stele began to rise, like a single finger at the end of a fist. Dirt and grit sifted down as the sepulcher pushed its way from below. Morn and Sister Fand, who had seen the process before, still gazed at the rising structure in something like awe. Carabatos rested his hand on the butt of his colt, waiting for the sepulcher's slow ascent to stop. When it did, a perfectly rectangular seam appeared in the featureless cube. By degrees, it widened and enlarged and opened. A figure wearing a black hooded cassock stepped out onto the windswept plateau. A silver chain girded his waist, and from it dangled a small charm, a talisman fashioned in the shape of three circle-topped triangles. Brother Morn ducked his head reverentially.
Father Bran, I ask admittance to the priory.
The priest tugged back his hood, revealed a bearded, blunt-jawed face and bright, questioning green eyes. The wind plucked at his red hair.
Kadishu.
Speak English.
An American of who?
Aye, he's an American. He's here as a representative of the Archon Directorate to enforce the pact.
The pact?
Between the Directorate and the Priory of Eowyn.
The time is not yet nigh.
Truly, that is the terrible thing, Father. It is nigh. Judgment Day is upon us. And now the pact struck by St. Patrick and the Neferot must be consummated.
Bran's face went the color of the sky. He stumbled back a pace as if he had been dealt a blow. He fixed his unblinking gaze on Sister Fand.
That cannot be. The blood of the Danann flows in our veins. To mingle it with the blood of the Neferot is an unspeakable sin.
Fuck this. It's the pact, you sanctimonious asshole. You knew one day you'd be called to account, or you wouldn't have sent him to act as your liaison. He's abiding by it, and so will you.
Please, Father, the Director have made their choice. Sister Fand has the purest blood, the cleanest line of descent.
No, I will not allow this blasphemy. St. Patrick did not envision the pact this way.
Ireland was to be free of the Neferot until Judgment Day. It is now at hand. The Priory of Eowyn was formed to protect humanity from the knowledge of the pact. If it is broken now, then our Brotherhood's work over the past 1,000 years is as smoke, a lie.
A pact with liars is no pact at all. St. Patrick would never have agreed had he known.
Take it up with Patrick when you see him.
The steel-jacketed round struck the priest above his right eye. The back of his skull exploded in jagged fragments and a halo of red mist. Morn lunged toward Carabatos, his fingers clawing for the man's face. He managed to snatch away the sunglasses right before the American raked the barrel of the automatic across the bridge of his nose. The blade sight tore flesh, crushed cartilage, and blood sprang out in rivulets. Sister Fand made a move toward Carabatos, but backed away when he pointed the gun in her direction.
Get up, Brother Morn.
Slowly, Morn stumbled erect, hand to his face, crimson streaming from between his fingers. His white cleric's collar slowly turned red as it absorbed the blood like blotting paper. He stepped unsteadily into the cube. Carabatos gathered a handful of Sister Fan's habit and pushed her forward. The interior of the sepulcher was as blank and featureless as the exterior, except for two buttons protruding from one wall. With the barrel of the Colt, Carabatos depressed one. The cube sealed. It began to drop, slowly and without a lurch. Morn tried to catch Sister Fan's gaze.
I'm sorry, sister.
She refused to meet his eyes. Carabatos placed his left hand inside a pouch that he carried. The automatic doors opened, and he stepped out quickly into the large, low-ceilinged room. It was filled with computer terminals and electronic communications equipment. Console and panel lights flashed and blinked purposefully. A bank of closed-circuit monitor screens ran the length of the far wall. Most of them showed images of the rough Atlantic seas. 6 people were seated before the consoles, 3 men and 3 women. All wore black cassocks with the silver triangle ornament dangling from their waists. They whirled when the doors rolled open, their faces masks of fear, shock, and rage. From Karabatos's hands leaped a pair of small metal cylinders. They bounced in a jerky zigzag fashion on the smooth floor before white smoke exploded from them in a thick pall. The priests and nuns reeled about the room, slamming into one another, stumbling and falling. Karabatos fired his Colt Delta at them. Karabatos stepped back inside the cube. He, Sister Fand, and Morn waited in the lift cube while the air recycling system cleared the room of the chemical fog. The American gave the fresh corpses a single, impassive glance as he stepped back into the room. He gestured with the automatic.
Move, sister.
You will burn in the deepest pit of hell for what you have done.
And by noon tomorrow, we'll have plenty of company. Take me to the crypt. Now.
Brother Morn saw no further point in hesitating or arguing. Leading Sister Fand by the elbow, he crossed the room, careful not to tread in the pools of blood. He pushed open a door and entered a cold gray corridor lit by fluorescent strips glowing on the ceiling. A sense of overlapping layers of history emanated from the stonework of the floor and walls. The corridor opened up after a few yards, and at its end stood an immense carved stone door with serpentine, spiraling, taltine designs incised across it. With narrowed eyes, Karabatos studied the ornate lintel, the threshold, and the jambs.
Open it.
Brother Morn's tongue touched his dry, blood-speckled lips. He stepped to the door. His hands pushed at the stone molding in several places, pressed certain points in certain ways. Then, very slowly, the great carved slab of stone began to tilt inward at the top. It was precisely balanced on oiled pivots. The aperture beyond was black with a darkness that was almost solid. A musty odor poured forth like invisible smoke.
Enter.
Do not presume to give us a brother and sister of the Priory commands. You are not an authority here.
Move!
Sister Fand was propelled into the blackness beyond the portal. Morn followed her. The light from the corridor barely penetrated into the murk as they walked slowly along the passage past half a dozen openings. The walls were covered with barely discernible straight-line inscriptions in Ogham, the ancient Celtic form of writing. Faded banners depicting incidents in the lives of various saints and warriors hung from pegs. Brother Morn found it painful to look at them. Blood dripped onto his black coat, spattering it with an artless red pattern. With Karabatos treading almost on his heels, Morn turned a hairpin corner and descended irregular stairs hewed out of rock. Ahead and below glowed a dim light. At the foot of the stairs was a gallery, a natural bowl-shaped cavern. The light shone from a dozen copper braziers placed in a circle around the curving rock walls. Painted on the cavern floor in greens and reds was a large cup and ring glyph, a semicircular spiral designed to entrap and destroy malignant entities. Morn and Sister Fand stepped across it, careful not to tread on the intricate labyrinth of lines. Shapes loomed in the shadows, objects and artifacts concealed by linen coverings. In a shallow recess sat two life-size images crafted out of stone. The right-hand statue squatted cross-legged in an attitude of meditation. It wore a cassock much like Father Brand's.
St. Patrick, founder of the Priory of Awen.
The left-hand statue was of a brawny, half-naked man, wearing a diadem of grinning human skulls above a grim, clean-shaved face. The right hand gripped a sword, but the point of the blade branched into the stylized image of three triangles. A pair of huge hounds crouched between his widespread legs, stone lips curled in vicious, fanged snarls.
Cuculain, the most savage yet deeply mystical warrior in Celtic legend. Patrick and Cuculain, peace and war. Yin and Yang.
Between the effigies rose an oblong pedestal 4 feet tall. Four small pyramids crafted from pale golden alloy were placed at equidistant points around it. Resting on their points was a smooth crystalline ovoid, around 8 feet long. It seemed filled with a cloudy, smoke-like substance. Behind it bulked the cylindrical outlines of two cryo units. Karabatos holstered his weapon and approached the pedestal cautiously. He put out a tentative hand toward the crystal surface. At his touch, the vapor within the ovoid immediately cleared.
Jesus,
Within lay a very tall, almost skeletally thin figure. Morn, who had always known it existed, deep in the Priory crypt, found himself cringing back. It was shaped like a man, but by no means human. Its cadaverous, excessively slender frame and narrow, elongated skull were completely hairless. The pale, brownish-gray skin, wrinkled and tough, stretched over protruding brow arches and jutting cheekbones. There was a suggestion of scaliness about it. A central ridge dipped down from the top of the domed head to the bridge of the flattened nose. Four long fingers, tipped with razor-sharp spurs of bone, were laced together on the creature's motionless chest. The large, almond-shaped eyes stared blindly, black vertical slits centered in the golden, opalescent irises. The eyes were the worst.
No myth, then. Enlil, the last of the Serpent Kings, held hostage here since 432 AD, the basis of the legends of Patrick driving the snakes from Ireland.
By the power of his word, he drove the whole pestilent swarm from the precipice headlong into the ocean.
Now we know he had a little help. Yet another of history's dirty little secrets.
He stooped, extending a groping hand beneath the crystal ovoid, fingers exploring the underside of the pedestal. Morn and Sister Fand watched as a sudden spasm of movement shook the lean form. Its lipless mouth opened slightly. Sister Fand and Morn knew it was the thing's laughter. Enlil was happy, gleefully, terribly happy. It turned its head, and for the first time, Sister Fand and Morn accepted it was a living creature, breathing, stirring, aware of its surroundings. Its gold and black eyes swept over the people, then fixed and focused on Sister Fand. They stared straight into her soul.
Swahadedanam.
The voice shocked them all. Karabatos glanced over his shoulder at the woman.
He recognizes you.
Sister Fand shrank back, face contorting. Karabatos reached for her, securing an arm lock on her bound wrists.
Since you two like quotes so much, here's an appropriate one from the Book of Enoch. When the evil angels descended and beheld the daughters of man, they began to corrupt themselves with them.
He jerked Fand forward, toward the pedestal. Enlil still lay prone. Flesh stirred and slid at the juncture of its thighs. A wrinkle of scaled skin folded back, allowing a thin stalk to push its way up, like a budless stem of a flower.
No! No, not this way! This isn't science! No offspring can be conceived this way!
How do you know? There's gotta be some reason for their extreme interest in human sexuality. Aren't you curious? I certainly am.
Enlil sat up, then stood. It was very tall, towering at least a foot over Karabatos. With a heave of his arms and shoulders, the American shoved Sister Fand toward Enlil. It caught her in its arms, and with one slash of claw-tipped fingers, stripped the habit from her body. She wore nothing underneath, and blood sprang in crimson lines along her back and shoulder blades, shockingly bright against the milky hue of her skin. Enlil whirled her around like a dancer, bending her half across the open cocoon. It stretched its frame over her. Through eyes half blinded by tears, Morn saw Enlil possessed a short, vestigial tail which dangled from the base of its spine. It forced open her thrashing legs.
You've broken the pact! And whatever issue springs from me will not swear fealty to your kind! Nothing will come from this union but generations of enemies! That is the new pact!
Morn spun away, crossing himself repeatedly. Tears flowed in a flood from his eyes, cutting fresh runnels in the drying blood on his face.
Son, go share a GM.
Karabatos slid a mock sympathetic arm around Morn's shaking shoulders.
Yeah, weddings always make me teary-eyed myself. Oh, be at peace, you big whiner.
Nearly 200 years after Doomsday, southwestern Idaho. Humankind took the permanence of the Earth for granted, and that was man's capital mistake. For thousands of years, the hills, mountains, valleys, plains, rivers, and seas had seldom altered. The few small localized changes were noticed only by geologists, whose time perceptions were measured in eons, not individual lifetimes. On January 20th, 2001, mountains walked, plains became inland seas, earthquakes and tidal waves re-sculpted coastal regions. Billions died. For the following generations, nothing was permanent, especially dreams of love, security, and a future. Kane caught those thoughts sneaking through his head and tried to chase them out. Too many monotonous hours behind the wheel of the Sandcat had turned his mental meanderings into sour, insipid longings. He remembered the good days in his life, but he also remembered far worse. When everything he had taken for granted sneered in his face and ran over the horizon of lost dreams, never to be seen again. Kane opened the obslit wide. An arid wind blew off the Bora Peak and across Hell's Canyon, ruffling his brown hair. He gazed out of the opening at the knee-high, unbroken plain of gamma grass. Twilight deepened around the vehicle, a sea of russet and indigo flowing down from the western sky. He tightened his hands around the horseshoe-shaped wheel and watched the first faint stars come out. His point-man senses reacted to the cool yet very dry touch of the breeze. Something was in it, a faint odor of fear. Kane glanced over at Domi, slumped and drowsing in the co-pilot's chair, her white-haired head bowed. In the rearward cargo compartment, Bridget Baptiste and Grant also napped, doing their best to catch up on lost sleep. Kane tried to relax. He sensed a brooding oppressiveness about this stretch of the Outlands, something he normally detected only in a hell zone. He steered the Sandcat slowly through the dusk, the 750-horsepower engine sounding strangely subdued. Its gray armored hull plowed through the rippling grass like the blunt prow of a ship. Like most everything manufactured in the Vills, the Sandcat was based on an existing pre-dark framework. Designed as an FAV, fast attack vehicle, for a ground war that was never fought, the Sandcat's low-slung, blocky chassis was supported by a pair of flat, retractable tracks. The gun turret, concealed within an armored bubble topside, held a pair of USMG 73 heavy machine guns. The hull's armor was composed of a ceramic armorglass bond, which served as protection from not only projectiles, but went opaque when exposed to energy-based weapons, such as particle beam emitters. The interior was the perfect size to comfortably hold four people. At the front of the compartment were the pilots' and co-pilots' chairs. The rear storage module housed the computer links for the electronic systems. A double row of three jump seats faced each other. The seats could be folded down to make serviceable narrow bunks. They were folded down now, holding the sleeping Grant and Baptiste. The Sandcat was one of two all-terrain vehicles in the Cerberus Redoubt. Kane had no idea how they had been brought in, since the Mattrans gateway chamber was not large enough to transport them from elsewhere. More than likely, the vehicles had been in the installation before the nuke cost, recently refurbished and modified by Lakesh and his refugee staff of tech heads. Thinking of Cerberus, Kane turned his thoughts inward again, dwelling on the events of the past week. Lakesh had returned from a week-long sojourn in Cobaltville with a grim report. A new harvest of genetic material was time to begin. The hybridization timetable that Kane, Grant, and Baptiste had overturned in New Mexico 5 months ago was being brought back on schedule. As usual, the Outlands were the hunting grounds, and the genetic material, human beings, would be harvested from the settlements. The news, though upsetting, was nothing less than any of them expected. Baron Cobalt, as the intermediary of the Archon Directorate, had to abide by the program, as did all the barons comprising the hybrid dynasty. The punitive expedition to New Mexico had only delayed the process, not stopped the centuries-old program. The first settlement earmarked for the harvest was listed on the map as Cuprum, in what was known in pre-dark times as Hell's Canyon National Recreation Area in Idaho. It was also the place Domi called home. The girl had said nothing when Lakesh related the news, and due to her albinism, no one could tell if she turned pale. She simply withdrew to her quarters. The Cerberus staff sympathized with her, particularly Grant. He more or less owed the half-feral girl his life, but her frequent amorous advances toward him always made him deal with her at arm's length. Though no one had an idea of her true age, Grant assumed he was at least old enough to be her father. It wasn't until Brigid spoke to her privately that they learned Domi still had family back in Cuprum. Tactically, the fact shouldn't have altered the situation. Domi was an outlander, an outrunner, a non-person by birth. Kane, Brigid, and Grant had been reclassified as such in the recent past, with on-site termination warrants hanging over them. Since their escape from Cobaltville, they had eluded capture simply by staying out of the Ville's sphere of influence. The Cerberus Redoubt was the best, and under the circumstances, the only place to remain hidden. A forgotten installation, and almost impossibly inaccessible, to leave it and risk apprehension seemed extraordinarily foolish and reckless. However, the purpose of the small, loosely knit resistance movement based in Cerberus was to oppose the Archon Directorate, something they hadn't actually implemented, despite a recent journey to Asia to investigate Archon presence there. So Kane, Grant, and Baptiste volunteered to go to Hell's Canyon with Domi as their guide. No functioning gateway units were located anywhere near Cuprum. The only option was overland in the Sandcat, traversing the treacherous mountain roads high in the darks. It was a journey no one had undertaken in close to a century. The gateways were major aspects of the pre-dark scientific project known as the Totality Concept. Gateway was the colloquial term for a quantum interphase transducer, otherwise referred to as a MAT-trans unit. Most of the units were buried in subterranean military complexes, known in the remnants of the United States as redoubts. Only a handful of people knew they even existed, and fewer than that knew all their locations. The knowledge had been lost after the new cost, rediscovered a century later, then jealously, ruthlessly guarded. There were, however, units in other countries. Japan, England, Canada, and Mongolia. The exact purpose of the units and of the totality concept itself had vanished when the ultimate nuclear holocaust had destroyed civilization across the entire world. The darks themselves had once been known as the Bitterroot Range, but the post-nukecost name suited them better. Treed with deeply shadowed forests, slashed by ravines, with a sinister mythology that had been ascribed to them for generations. The road leading down from Cerberus was little more than a twisted asphalt ribbon, skirting yawning chasms and cliffs. Acres of the mountainsides had collapsed during the nuke-triggered earthquakes nearly two centuries ago. It was a tortuous, nerve-wracking trek that took nearly an entire day before they reached the foothills. After that, the trip was relatively speedy and smooth. The weather held, and the instruments in the Sandcat showed tolerable levels of ambient radiation. Only twice did they come near orange or warm zones. The far western inland states had, for the most part, been spared direct strikes. Still, the shocks triggered by the Russian Earthshaker bombs had re-sculpted much of the west coast. For 5 days, the Sandcat rolled steadily along old Interstate 95. They passed piles of overgrown rubble that had once been cities. A few old buildings still rose at the skyline, then broke off with ragged abruptness. They saw very few people and fewer animals. At the end of the fifth day, following Domi's directions, Kane steered the vehicle off the interstate and onto a vista of unbroken grasslands.
Almost there.
Kane wondered how she had managed to get from this particular ass end of nowhere to the Tartarus pits of Cobaltville, hundreds of miles away in Colorado. In retrospect, it was no great mystery. Wag trains of outlanders often traveled to the network of vills scattered across the rad-blasted face of America, hoping to enter them legally or illegally. Kane stole another glance toward her. Domi seemed too childlike to be a woman. yet there was no mistake about it. Her skin was perfectly white and beautiful, like polished porcelain, and her untidy, bone-white hair was cropped close to her small, hollow-cheeked face. Her eyes, hidden now by closed lids, were the color of rubies. She wore a red jerkin of some silky stuff, leaving 90% of her long, slim legs bare, and the curved shape beneath it was something to wonder at. Actually, Kane reflected, it wasn't something to wonder at. Baptiste had admonished Domi more than once for strolling through the vanadium alloy halls of Cerberus wearing nothing but red stockings. Few of the male residents had lodged objections. Old Lakesh, in particular, never seemed to mind.
What's going on?
We're here.
The terrain appeared perfectly flat, but the gully was wide and cut in clean like a surgical incision, hidden by the high grasses. Only Kane's point man senses had kept them from driving over the edge. All of them disembarked, walking to the gully's lip. Domi pointed eastward.
That way, a quarter mile.
We could be too late, you know.
A very tall, very broad-shouldered man, Grant's thick brows were drawn, shadowing his dark eyes. A newly grown, down-sweeping mustache showed jet black against the coffee brown of his skin. Beneath it, his heavy-jawed face was set in a perpetual scowl. Gray showed at the temples of his short hair, as if sprinkled there by a diffident hand. Near Grant stood Bridget Baptiste. Her willowy, athletic figure reflected an unusual strength without detracting from her undeniable femininity. She was tall, full-breasted, and long-limbed. An unruly mane of long, red-gold hair spilled over her shoulders, framing a smoothly sculpted face with a rosy complexion, dusted lightly with freckles across her nose and cheeks. There was a softness in her features that bespoke a deep wellspring of compassion, yet a hint of iron resolve was there, too. The color of emeralds glittered in her big eyes.
Lakesh said the op was 10 days away. We're in plenty of time to warn the settlement.
Or we're in plenty of time to walk into a trap.
An inch over 6 feet, Kane was not as tall or as broad as Grant. Every line of his body was hard and stripped of excess flesh. He looked like a warrior, from the hawk-like set of his head, on the corded neck, to the square shoulders and the lean hips and long legs. Kane was built with the savage economy of a gray wolf. His high-planed face, now sporting a 5-day growth of beard stubble, held a watchful expression, as did his narrowed gray-blue eyes. Except for Domi, all of them wore drab, neutral-colored clothes, the coarse attire typical of the average outlander.
Is this just your normal paranoia, or is this the point man in you talking?
Not much difference, is there?
Are you suggesting we scrub after all we went through to get here?
No, Baptiste. I'm suggesting we approach the situation like we would a hell zone.
Tactics?
You and Domi stay here, while Baptiste and I recon the zone. We'll patch in a comm link to the cat.
Let's get you geared up.
He and Kane walked to the back of the vehicle and opened a cargo compartment, wrestling out a medium-sized trunk, finished with leather and cornered by steel. Grant lifted the lid while Kane quickly stripped off his clothes. From the trunk, Grant removed the one-piece Kevlar undergarment and handed it to Kane. He slipped it on, zipping it up and sealing the wrist and ankle tabs. Next came several oddly shaped jet-black objects. With routine ease, Kane donned the magistrate armor. The molded polycarbonate breast and back plates came first. After fastening the side seals, Kane slipped on the ebony arm sheathings, locking them magnetically against the shoulder epaulets. The leggings came next, then the high, thick-soled boots. Grant handed him the gauntlets, and he tugged them on. Grant ran his fingers over the joints of the body armor, making certain all the seals were secure. The armor was close-fitting, molded to conform to the biceps, triceps, pectorals, and abdomen. Even with its Kevlar undersheathing, the armor was lightweight and provided no loose folds to snag against projections. The only spot of color anywhere on it was the small, disc-shaped badge of office emblazoned on the left pectoral. It depicted, in crimson, a stylized, balanced scales of justice superimposed over a 9-spoked wheel. The badge symbolized the magistrate's oath to keep the wheels of justice turning in the 9 baronies. But now, the only emotional resonance it carried was one of bitter betrayal. Grant handed Kane his helmet. Like the armor encasing his body, the helmet was made of black polycarbonate and fitted over the upper half and back of his head, leaving only a portion of the mouth and chin exposed. The slightly concave red-tinted visor served several functions. It protected the eyes from foreign particles, and the electrochemical polymer was connected to a passive night sight that intensified ambient light to permit one-color night vision. The tiny image enhancer sensor mounted on the forehead of the helmet did not emit detectable rays, though its range was only 25 feet, even on a fairly clear night with strong moonlight. Kane slipped the helmet over his head, securing the underjaw lock guards. He strapped the Sin-Eater's holster to his right forearm. A big-bore automatic hand blaster, the Sin-Eater was less than 14 inches in length at full extension, the magazine carrying 20 9mm rounds. When not in use, the stock folded over the top of the blaster, lying along the frame, reducing its holstered length to 10 inches. When the Sin-Eater was needed, Kane would tense his wrist tendons, and sensitive actuators activated a flexible cable in the holster and snapped the weapon smoothly into his waiting hand, the stock unfolding in the same motion. Since the Sin-Eater had no trigger guard or safety, the blaster fired immediately upon a touch of his crooked index finger. Kane lowered his right hand to the familiar handle of the 14-inch-long combat knife scabbarded in his boot. Honed to a razor-keen cutting edge, it was also balanced for throwing. When Kane walked back to the edge of the gully, Domi and Bridget cast him swift, fearful glances. The man they knew and with whom they had shared days and nights in cramped quarters had vanished, replaced by the grim enforcer of the cruel laws of the baronies. Grant noticed the sudden fear in the eyes of both women, and again he realized the magistrate armor was designed for more than functional, practical reasons. Kane was now a symbol of awe, of fear. He looked bigger somehow, strong, fierce, implacable.
Let's get to it.
Domi, how long has it been since you were here last?
A year, maybe two.
How many people lived here when you left?
I don't know, a lot.
Kane repressed the urge to sigh in exasperation. The albino girl was essentially illiterate, and he doubted she could count much higher than 20. There was no point in blaming her for her ignorance. Even the most rudimentary education was available only to a select few. In fact, basic education was actually banned in the outlands under direct baronial control. Anyone even suspected of possessing knowledge beyond simple survival skills was marked for termination. It was all part of the doctrine expressed by the unification program. The reasons for the antipathy toward education of the masses were simple. Human beings were no more than livestock, and if livestock ever realized they were owned, then they might question the wherefores of it. Domi led them about 200 feet along the edge of the gully to where it dipped down in a series of broken steps chipped out of rock.
This is the safe way down.
Mm-hmm. Grant, stay in touch. I don't know how long we'll be.
We wait here, Grant. Just us two.
The girl had attached herself to Grant back in Cobaltville, and she responded with almost pathetic eagerness to any attention he directed toward her. She slipped an arm through his, ignoring his uncomfortable shifting of feet.
Take your time, Kane.
The gully floor curved lazily, and the fresh night air acted as a stimulant, driving away the cobwebs of fatigue. Bridget and Kane heard the river up ahead. Though it was dark, the light enhancer on his helmet made the channel of stone and undergrowth easy to negotiate. They began seeing signs of human habitation scattered along the path, rusting, gutted husks of old vehicles that had lain there since skydark, overgrown now with vines.
Huh. Domi told me she was born in one of those.
Piles of rotting garbage now lined both sides of the gully, heaped so high and narrowing the pass so much they were forced to walk in single file. The gully opened up at the edge of a widely cleared dirt area. Surrounded by brush, it was like a bald spot on top of a hairy man's head. The dirt was hard-packed from the pressure of many feet over many years. In the center of the barren circle was the remains of a communal fire, charred logs crisscrossing at opposing angles. A path, wide and straight, stretched out from the far edge of the clearing, leading between double rows of huts, shanties, and lean-tos. The place looked like it had been abandoned forever.
Status?
Nothing, Grant. The place is deserted. We'll keep looking. Stand by.
Cain and Brigid moved to the right, along the edge of the brush line. His black armor and her drab clothing helped them blend with the shifting pattern of moonlight and shadows. He kept the Sin-Eater leathered snugly on his forearm, but he drew his combat knife and used it to slash and push aside foliage in their path. Brigid followed several paces behind him, trying to walk stealthily, like Cain. She was very light-footed, but she didn't have his years of experience in penetrating potential kill zones. As Cain crept along the brush-lined perimeter, he peered closely at the ground. He saw the marks of many feet and twigs stepped on and broken. His sixth sense, which had been observing everything from the back of his mind, suddenly screeched for attention. He wasn't sure why. In his years as a mag, he had come across any number of deserted outland settlements, but the circumstances had easy explanations. Famines, incursions of roamer bands, or simply dissatisfaction with the territory. Always some sign had been left, or the outlanders would turn up again somewhere else, usually around one of the vills. If Domi's village had been the target of a mag hard contact, corpses and burned-out dwellings would be the signs. As a general rule, when mags cleaned out a settlement for whatever reason, the only negotiation was whether to switch their blasters from semi to full auto.
In 1930 came, a village of over 1,000 Inuit vanished without a trace. There were no signs of violence, and no bodies or survivors were ever found. Even the graves of the cemetery had been opened and the remains removed. A search that covered the whole of Canada turned up nothing.
Did you learn that while you were an archivist? Or from the Cerberus database?
Does it matter? From the database, if you must know, when I was cross-indexing Archon activities in the century preceding the nuke cost. It was a generalized reference, but I remembered it.
Do you think there's anything you don't remember?
No.
Kay knew in advance that would be her answer. As the possessor of an eidetic memory, she could say nothing else. Besides, it was true. Brigid Baptiste remembered everything she read or saw. And that was how and why she also ended up as an exile. He reminded himself wryly that he had a little something to do with her exile, too. As soon as the memory registered, the edge of tension that always seemed to pass between him and Brigid when they were alone became palpable. He never could understand why it always lurked there. Explaining it away as the natural conflict between two contrasting personalities, one inclined toward action, one toward cool analysis, was unsatisfactory. It was something deeper, something far more complex and mysterious than a simple personality clash. A recent Mattrans jump had gone bad. Both he and Baptiste had suffered from jump sickness, the primary symptoms of which were nausea and vivid and frighteningly real nightmares. In this instance, they had shared the same hallucination, but they were due less to quantum energy-inspired deliriums than revelations that he and Baptiste were somehow joined by spiritual chains, linked to each other and to the same destiny. Cain didn't possess a metaphysical turn of mind, though he wasn't in the habit of flatly denying the possibility of anything. What he had learned of humanity's secret history saw to that. Still, the notion that their souls had been together for 1,000 years or more seemed absurd. However, it was more than coincidence that caused them to have the same jump nightmare. He knew there had to be a causal factor, and clearly Baptiste did too. They just didn't want to discuss it. While recovering from injuries they'd sustained in the Black Gobi, Cain had tried to avoid being alone with Baptiste as much as possible. Fortunately, Cerberus was so vast, it wasn't difficult. Grant had told him Baptiste saved his life, coming within a hairbreadth of losing her own in the process. Cain had yet to thank her, and he didn't know why, except he had the vague feeling it was an action she had been fated to perform, rectifying a mistake made long, long ago, before either one of them had been born. The whole concept made him feel distinctly uneasy, and therefore he had been distant with Baptiste, dealing with her cordially but formally. If the woman objected to his behavior, she showed no sign of it. In fact, she seemed relieved. Or she had until now. Cain walked swiftly to the far side of the settlement's perimeter. A tangled strip of undergrowth sloped sharply down to the bank of the Snake River. Utter silence hung over the riverfront, unbroken by even the croaking of frogs. A few yards away was a small bluff. Built at the top of the bluff, extending over it and down, was a flume, a chute made of battered tin supported by cross-braced struts of iron and wood. It angled down sharply to the river, following the face of the bank. A few wooden buckets lay scattered beneath it.
Status, Kane?
Nothing, Grant.
Lockash must have picked up bad intel.
Or he was fed some.
What do you mean, Kane?
I mean it's possible, if not probable, that Baron Kobold, or Salvo, suspects Lockash of insurgency. This whole lot may be a setup and a trap. Grant, ask Domi if her people would have simply picked up and moved on.
Hang on. Domi, could they have left on their own? Domi says no. Her people have been here a very long time and liked it. They wouldn't go on their own.
They could simply have been taken.
There'd be some sign. Houses torn up, blood on the ground, something.
We don't know how a harvest is conducted. Even Lockesh knows very little about how the Directorate operates. We'll keep looking, Grant. Stand by.
Kane and Bridget walked swiftly toward the village proper. There was a rustling sound from inside one of the huts, and they spun toward it, hands reaching for their weapons. The Sin-Eater filled Kane's hand, and he leveled it, finger lightly touching the trigger, while Bridget still fumbled to draw her Mauser. An elderly man stepped cautiously out of the hut, holding a metal wash basin over his head as though it were an oversized sun helmet. His skinny body was bare from the waist up. He wore a piece of red canvas as a loincloth, and over his eyes were two pairs of reflective sunglasses. In these circumstances, he looked like a marooned tourist.
Who are you?
Hello. Sorry I missed you last night.